The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If impeachment is about deterrence, then it should deter a president for the entire term, rather than say, if you do something wrong, if you commit a high crime or misdemeanor, and it's early enough in your term, then you're going to face consequences for it, including disqualification. But hey, if you wait until the end of the term, then you can do whatever you want, and we can't do anything about it. That doesn't seem like the structure the framers thought they were setting up. And that's important going forward. When we talked about impeachment maybe not happening until the person is gone, when Bill Clinton on his last day pardoned Mark Rich, if that had turned out to be a pardon for a bribe, that might have been worth impeaching. So we've got to keep that deterrent effect that is at the core of what impeachment is all about going all the way to January 20th.
I'm Jack Goldsmith, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 13th, 2021. I sat down with Brian Cult, a law professor at Michigan State University, to talk about an important issue in the news this week, late impeachments. In the current context, the issue of a late impeachment would arise if the House of Representatives impeaches President Trump before he leaves office, but the Senate doesn't hold the trial for Trump, with possible conviction and disqualification from further office until after he leaves office. Professor Cult and I discussed how the Constitution and its historical background and structure inform this question, as well as what the practice of impeachments over 230 years teaches us. We also talked about how former President Trump might challenge any trial, conviction, or disqualification that takes place after he leaves office. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 13th, Late Impeachments. So there's a very important question in Washington, D.C. right now, whether it is constitutional for a president to be impeached while in office and then convicted and possibly disqualified from further office after he leaves office. This is a so-called late impeachment. And the question is that we're going to address today is whether or not the Constitution permits that. To address this question today, we have literally the world's expert, Brian Cult. He wrote an op-ed on this topic in the last day or so. He has a chapter on this topic in his great book called Constitutional Cliffhangers. And that chapter, in turn, is based on a very long law review article he wrote about the topic. Brian, I think it's fair to say that you've looked at this question more deeply than anyone. So I'm very happy to talk to you about it today.
I'm always happy to talk about it, too. I liked it better when it was hypothetical, but...
But it's very real now. So before we get to dive into the question before us, can you just explain for our listeners the basics of what's settled in the Constitution about how impeachment works?
The impeachment clauses in the Constitution are some in Article 1, and they say the House is in charge of impeachment, the Senate is in charge of trials, punishment is limited to removal from office and disqualification to hold future office. They can't go beyond that. And then some procedural requirements. And then in Article 2, it says the president, vice president, and all civil officers are removed from office if they're convicted of high crimes and misdemeanors. So basically, the House, by a simple majority, impeaches someone. The Senate, by a two-thirds majority, convicts that person. If that person is still in office, they are removed from office. And then the Senate can choose to provide this additional punishment of disqualification.
Right. Okay, so we'll get back to some of those details in a second. But so the question at issue this week is whether if the House of Representatives impeaches Donald Trump, it seems unlikely that the Senate will be able to conduct a trial during his term in office. So the trial, if any, would have to be conducted after he leaves office. And the question that we're basically asking is whether that's permissible, whether a trial and conviction and potential disqualification can occur after the president leaves office. Is that a fair way of putting the question?
Sure. What I wrote about was whether they can impeach him, begin the process when he's already gone, when the president or whoever is already gone. So this is a somewhat easier case.
Yeah. So that's right. So there is another question which we're not going to address. We're assuming that the House will impeach. There's another question which you address in your book about whether the impeachment itself, in addition to the conviction, can take place afterwards. And that may happen. We don't know yet whether there's going to be an impeachment this week or before he leaves office. But let's just assume that there's going to be and focus on the question of conviction afterwards. And we'll, for purposes of this conversation, we'll call that a late impeachment, even though it's really a late trial and potential conviction. So before we get into, and I'm afraid we're gonna look carefully at the text, and which is fine. Before we get into looking at the text, let's focus on what the question is we're asking, because I think this has been glossed over a little bit in the conversation. Are we looking for the best, most correct, most defensible interpretation of the Constitution as to whether it permits this, or are we looking at a permissible interpretation for the Senate? What is the right way to approach this question?
I think that the question I've been asking in the 20 odd years I've been looking at this is what's the best interpretation? And in doing that, I have to conclude that either interpretation is permissible. That is, there are more than enough reasonable arguments on both sides to support either result. But that's not good enough, right? Senators, representatives, they need to vote yes or no. And so I think they should each try to figure out not just what they could get away with, but what the best answer is.
And should members of the Senate use the same interpretive methods that courts use? I mean, is it like a judicial inquiry?
I think, well, there are a lot of lawyers in Congress. And so I think a lot of them sort of tend to that approach. But I think that it's a fundamentally different enterprise. It matters that the Constitution gave this process to politicians to decide. And so I think it's inevitable that there will be political thinking mixed into these questions. If I were a member of Congress, I would try to get the best interpretation. I would try to interpret it the way a court would, particularly because there probably won't be, I suppose I shouldn't rule that out, and we'll probably talk about that, but there probably won't be a court looking at this. The court might defer to Congress and give them that role of getting the last word. So there's no way for Congress to hide behind judicial review and say, well, we'll do whatever we think is right. And if the court doesn't like it, that's the court's problem. No, we have to, if the court's not going to review it, we have to interpret it the way the court would, because we're filling that role.
So I do want to talk about that question of judicial review later, but let's just get it up on the table a little bit more. You're talking about the notion that if this question is presented in litigation in some form, and we can talk later about the forms it may be presented, that a court might rule that this is a so-called political question, that this is an issue that the Constitution, the question of late impeachments, that this is an issue that the Constitution gives to the Senate to decide and not the courts. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. And to the House. So when right. Article 1 says the House has the sole power, when the Senate is given the sole power to try impeachment, sole power means sole power. It's up to them to define what is an impeachment, what is within those bounds.
Okay. All right. So let's go to the question. When I first looked at this issue and I look at the text of the Constitution, it seems to me that the text considered alone, at least at first glance, presents some pretty powerful arguments against late impeachments. And mainly, and I've heard many people put it this way, Article 2, Section 4 says the president, the vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. It says the president, not the ex-president, and it says shall be removed and not something else. So that strikes me, and there are other provisions, obviously. That strikes me, if you just zeroed in on Article 2, Section 4, it would seem to rule out self-impeachment. Is that fair, or is there another way to read it?
Well, there are a bunch of other ways to read it, and I think that's part of the reason my article ended up being 50,000 words. But I think that the approach that you just laid out is, in essence, the strongest argument against late impeachment, that it talks about presidents, not ex-presidents. It talks about removal. But there are other ways to read it, and there are other parts of the Constitution that need to be considered too. So when you pull all that in, it gets a lot more complicated, but I think it also comes out the other way.
So tell us what the other textual, just focusing on the text before we get to the other interpretive factors, what are the other textual considerations that cut in the other direction or that dislodge that what might be viewed as a simple or a simplistic approach to the question?
Well, the first thing to do is to look a little more closely at Article 2, Section 4. And to be precise, it doesn't say the only way impeachment works is presidents, vice presidents, and other civil officers are removed if they're convicted of high crimes and misdemeanors. What it says is, if they are convicted, then they are removed. It doesn't say that those are the only people who can be impeached. It doesn't say that that's the only punishment. We know that's not the case. It's only specifying that removal is mandatory if the person who was just convicted is still in office. So once you look at it as making mandatory the penalty of removal, then you have to look somewhere else for the scope. And that search starts with Article 1. It says the House has the sole power of impeachment. So what's impeachment? There's a very well-developed understanding at the time of the founding that impeachment is about public officials committing public misconduct and looking at how they looked at it then. The trial doesn't need to be at the time the person is still in office. The offense does. It's about a grand inquest into public misconduct. It's about accountability. It's about deterrence. It's also about removal in some states before the Constitution was written, but it's about those other things too. And those other things are important, and late impeachment makes them possible. So the text of the Constitution talks about impeachment. So we look at what was impeachment. In 1787, what was impeachment? And looking at what the history tells us, late impeachment was part of the picture then.
But there's a standard problem in trying to figure out when we look at terms of the Constitution against the background against which they were understood. I'm thinking of, for example, the judicial power. There's a sense in which the framers were operating against a background understanding of the term, and that's certainly true of impeachment. But it's also true that the Constitution kind of changes some aspects of the prior understanding of impeachment. I mean, it limits it in certain ways against the English baseline. It doesn't replicate completely what the states were doing. So most of what you just said was about what the background understanding of impeachment was. And I guess the question is, how do we know that they were accepting that understanding as opposed to changing it?
Well, we don't. It is an ambiguous question. But one thing I think that's very important is what you just pointed out, that there were a lot of things that they did change, that they made specific. So, for instance, requiring a two-thirds majority for conviction, that wouldn't go without saying. Having the Senate be the one that does the trial as opposed to a court, that didn't go without saying. There are several limits on the power that they specified. And if late impeachment was seen as being part of the mix, if they wanted that to not be a thing, then they would have had to specify it, the argument goes, and they didn't. So you take impeachment, you specify the things you want to make clear you're changing, and everything else is still there.
Okay, you also make some structural arguments, structural constitutional arguments in favor of late impeachment. Can you go over those?
Sure. So a lot of those relate to the importance of disqualification. If disqualification is meaningful, and I think we have to assume that it was put in there because they wanted it to mean something, then it would be weird if the defendant in an impeachment case could avoid it simply by resigning. And another more complicated structural point, which deals with impeaching people other than the president, is there's an exception to the pardon power. The president can't pardon away an impeachment. So, and this goes back to an English precedent where the king was worried that his bad deeds would be uncovered if there was an impeachment. So he pardoned away the impeachment, shut down the impeachment. Presidents can't do that. They can't use their pardon power that way. If a president wanted to stop an impeachment, and it was someone other than himself in the executive branch, he could fire that person. And if that deprived Congress of jurisdiction over the case, that would be at odds with the notion that impeachment is supposed to be up to Congress in a way the president can't touch. So there's that. And then a final structural point that I think is important, and it's also just as a matter of policy, but if impeachment is about deterrence, and the record shows that that was a big concern of theirs, a lot of presidential abuses they wanted to deter, and the way to do that was the threat of impeachment, then it should deter a president for the entire term. Rather than say, if you do something wrong, if you commit a high crime or misdemeanor, and it's early enough in your term, then you're going to face consequences for it, including disqualification. But hey, if you wait until the end of the term, then you can do whatever you want, and we can't do anything about it. That doesn't seem like the structure the framers thought they were setting up. And that's important going forward. When we talked about impeachment maybe not happening until the person is gone, when Bill Clinton on his last day pardoned Mark Rich, if that had turned out to be a pardon for a bribe, that might have been worth impeaching. It was talked about at the time. So we've got to keep that deterrent effect that is at the core of what impeachment is all about going all the way to January 20th.
Okay, those are powerful reasons. I just want to come back to the first one because you said it quickly and I want to make sure everyone understands it. And that is the argument that disqualification from office for committing an impeachable offense is written into the Constitution and is obviously an important element of the impeachment power overall. And your point was that if one could avoid disqualification simply by resigning, then it would seem to make it too easy to circumvent that check. Is that the right way of putting it?
Yeah, it must be meaningful. And if it's that easy to avoid, the only people who would fight it, who would take the trial all the way to the end and risk being disqualified, would be the ones who weren't clearly guilty. So not only would people be able to avoid disqualification, the people most likely to do it would be the ones who are most obviously guilty. And it seems a little odd to give Congress the power to do something and then give the defendant the power to take that away.
Right. Okay, let's turn to the precedents. And again, these are, I wouldn't call these clinching, but they're at least suggestive and maybe more than suggestive. Can you walk through the main ones?
Yeah. So there's a sense. So when I give a little bit of background here, when they were discussing the impeachment power, they weren't clear on whether it would apply to the president whilst in office, as they said. That was the debate. Would it apply to him whilst in office? They eventually decided that it would. And so that's where we get the Article II language. But the very first impeachment case that we had was against a senator. And Senator Blount from Tennessee was impeached for some shenanigans. He was then expelled from the Senate. And the Senate, by expelling him, I think probably thought that they were ending matters. But the House continued at that point. They had impeached him, but they hadn't done the formal articles of impeachment. So even though he was already expelled, they went forward, they did the articles, they sent that to the Senate. The Senate had a trial. And the first question was, can we do this if he's already gone? And they said, sure, they went ahead with that. Then the second question was, can we do this given that he was a senator? And senators aren't civil officers. And we have this other provision for getting rid of people that are in Congress, the expulsion power. We can discipline members. That's in Article I, and they've disciplined people even after they've left office. So they talked about that, and they took a vote, and they said by a vote of 14-11, you can't impeach a senator. It's a little vague exactly what they were saying there, but it stands generally for the proposition that you can't impeach a senator. You certainly can't try one. And the fact that he was already gone wasn't really much of a problem at all. That was the very first impeachment. So I think we need to give that a fair amount of weight.
So just to be clear on that now, isn't it settled now that impeachment is not for members of Congress?
Well, yeah, that's the case that settled.
That's the precedent that settled it. Yeah, okay, good. Okay, but the assumption along the way was that a late impeachment was possible, and that's why it's an important precedent, especially since it's the first impeachment.
Yes, and at that time, there were states impeaching people who had already left office, right? It was a thing. The British precedents were late. So then very quickly, the next thing was people saw impeachment as a way to vindicate themselves, say, hey, you think I did something wrong? Come at me. Let's have an impeachment. And John C. Calhoun was accused of some things from previous office when he was Secretary of War. And he said, hey, go ahead and impeach me. And Daniel Webster, same thing. So we have in the congressional debates, people saying things like John Quincy Adams, for instance, standing up and saying, I hold myself, so long as I have the breath of life in my body, amenable to impeachment by this House for everything I did during the time I held any public office. And then the biggest precedent was the Belknap case. 1876, the Secretary of War is getting kickbacks and it gets discovered and he doesn't want to be impeached. So he resigns hours before the House votes, but the House goes forward anyway. They don't have much of a problem with impeaching him, even though he's gone, and they send it to the Senate. And this isn't an election year. So a lot of this is the Democrats are running against the Grant administration being corrupt. The Republicans want to get this over with. And so there's a little bit of an overlay of that on there. But there was a month of debate in the Senate over whether they had jurisdiction or not. And pretty much all the arguments that I raised in my article came up in that debate. It was a wonderful constitutional law debate. And in the end, they voted that they did have jurisdiction. But it's not the clearest precedent because they only had a simple majority. It was a 37-29 vote. And so they said, okay, we have jurisdiction. They went and had 2 months worth of trial at that point. But Belknap was acquitted. And the main reason he was acquitted was people didn't want to convict someone who was already gone. So it's an ambiguous precedent. I mean, you can have the trial. They had the trial. They spent 3 months on it. But what do we make of the fact that no one has been convicted after leaving office? It makes the precedent weaker than it might be.
Right. And how about some judges? Weren't there some judges who had late impeachments?
Well, there's some cases on that. Judge Archibald was impeached and convicted in 1912, and some of the charges against him were from some of the articles were conduct that he committed in a previous office. So you could look at that. And then Judge English in 1926 was impeached and then he resigned. And the House decided that they weren't going to go forward with it. But when they said that, what they said to the Senate was, the House resolution said that the House did not desire further to urge the articles of impeachment. Not that they couldn't, but that they just chose not to. And the House managers told the Senate that it was their position that the resignation in no way affects the right of the Senate, sitting as a court of impeachment, to hear and determine the charges. And the senators talked about it, and there was a lot of back and forth about whether it was worth it to go forward. Some people said we could if we wanted, but they just dropped it because it wasn't worth it. The guy was old. He wasn't going to ever serve again, so disqualification didn't really matter. And there have been other cases involving judges since then where there's a resignation, they drop the case, but when they drop the case, they use that language of choosing not to proceed.
Yeah. So you are scrupulously fair in your book and your articles and laying out these precedents. And my assessment of them is that they all point in one direction, but they're all kind of dicta or suggestive or not exactly square rulings, except maybe the first kind of jurisdictional ruling in Belknap, which even that got undermined a little bit. So while I completely agree with you that the precedents, such as they are, kind of point in one direction, there's kind of a frustrating lack of what I would call settled sort of holdings and rulings on this. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's a very fair assessment, and I think that's why it's still an open question. And I think that's true of a lot of things about impeachment. We have things that keep happening, and then a new impeachment case comes up, and people say this can't be done, and others say, well, it's been done before, but it keeps coming up. And I think that's what we will see. The House will probably impeach. We will see a trial, and at that trial, I guarantee you, they will spend a lot of time talking about things other than what President Trump did, such as, can we do this? And people inclined to support Trump will say, no, we can't. And people inclined to go after him will say, yes, we can. And I doubt, unless there's a conviction, I doubt that this case will settle the question either, even though there will be a trial.
I agree with that. I predict, along the lines of what you just said, that a very good chunk of the time taken up by the Trump defenders will focus on whether incitement in this context can be a basis for impeachment, and especially this jurisdictional question, whether there can be late impeachments. And I think there will be a lot of focus on those constitutional issues and by the Trump supporters, and much less of a kind of defense on the merits, so to speak, which I guess is typical also. So let's go back to how this would sort itself out. First of all, there seems to be some disagreement about how many votes in the Senate it takes to disqualify, whether that's two-thirds or one-half. So let's say that the Senate has a trial. Let's say it votes by at least two-thirds to convict former President Trump. Then the question comes about whether he should be disqualified from future office. Is it half or two-thirds for that vote?
That vote is a simple majority. Of course, you don't get there until you have the two-thirds vote to convict, but there is precedent. So the Senate has only disqualified three people. One of those votes was Judge Archibald, who we mentioned before. That was a 39-35 vote, but the Senate said that's good enough. And so we do have a precedent on that. I suppose there would be argument about that too. But the one case we have tells us that after getting two-thirds to convict, the sentence itself of disqualification only requires that simple majority.
And how about the question, I know some people believe, and I don't know if you have a view on this, that the disqualification possibility does not extend to the president. It only extends to appointed office and not elected office. Is that wrong?
It's a very tough question. I believe that it does apply to the presidency, but the disqualification applies to offices under the United States. And I think people don't agree that it only applies to appointed office. Some people would like that to apply to congressional office, although the Constitution makes pretty clear to me that Congress and offices under the United States are two different things. And in fact, you're not allowed to be in both at the same time. Whether the president is an officer under the United States, whether that term means a federal official more generally, or it means, as some have said, a statutory office created under the Constitution, not a constitutional office, that would be debated. It's hard to see how best to resolve that. I suppose a court could decide that as a matter of ballot access before things get too far along. But yeah, it's contestable. And I think that it would disqualify someone from being president, but I recognize that the arguments on the other side here too are serious.
And that will certainly probably be, if it gets to that point, that will certainly be raised in the Senate as well. So you mentioned ballot access, and I want to turn to the question of how this might be tested in courts. And I don't know how much you've thought this through, but so let's imagine that President Trump is impeached by the House and that former President Trump is convicted by two-thirds of the Senate and is by at least a majority to vote disqualified from holding any office of honor, trust, or profit. And assume that means, let's assume that there's a judgment made in the Senate that means he can't run for president again. And then let's say in 4 years or 3 years, Trump decides he wants to run for election again. What are some of the scenarios? I don't know if you've thought this through about where it could come up. The first place I imagine it will come up is when he tries to get on the ballot in the states and there will presumably be legal objections. So maybe in the first instance, this gets litigated or at least adjudicated in the states. Is that one way it'll happen?
I think that would be the best way for it to happen, because then it would be ideally litigated and settled early on enough in the process that whatever the result is, we can just take that and move on. We don't want the result to be after the people have voted in substantial numbers. So in the primaries would be the best. We don't want to have an election and then only after someone wins have the court say that they can't actually win. Although if that happens, the 20th Amendment would just have whoever the vice president elect is step in. So it wouldn't be that fatal, but if at all possible, let's decide things before people vote.
And presumably it would come up that way. I mean, there would be contestation in some states as to whether he get on the ballot. I imagine someone would have standing. I guess Trump would have standing if he was denied access to the ballot. And then the issue could come up and be litigated, perhaps going all the way to the court, perhaps, you know, long before the election.
It could come up earlier. I mean, he could seek a declaratory judgment. And if he announces his intention to run and says, look, I got to start now, I could see him having standing. Whether it's a political question or not, I don't know. But standing shouldn't be a problem.
So let's turn to that. Can you just tell the listeners about United States versus Nixon, and because that's a closely related context?
Sure. The political question doctrine, I look at the Nixon case, Walter Nixon, not Richard Nixon, the Walter Nixon case and the Powell versus McCormick case on this. So the Nixon case, Judge Nixon was impeached and put on trial, and he didn't like the way the Senate did it. They had a committee. He thought everything should be done by the full Senate, some other things. So he sued, and the Supreme Court said the Constitution says the Senate is the body in charge of trying this. It's totally up to them. It's not up to us at all. We have no jurisdiction. This is not justiciable. But that's about some internal matter. They try someone who's been impeached, and then we decide how best to do it. Well, that's up to the Senate. But Powell versus McCormick provides a different view of the political question doctrine that I think might come up in a late impeachment case. In Powell was accused of corruption, and there was a majority of the House that voted not to seat him. And he said, you can't refuse to seat me. I have met all the qualifications. I won the election. I'm at least 25 years old, and I live in the state where I'm a representative from. And you can't add qualifications. And yes, the political question here is that the House is the sole judge of the qualifications of its members, but that doesn't mean you get to make up new qualifications. And the Supreme Court agreed and said, the House is unreviewable within the bounds of its authority here, but we, the court, have a role to play in deciding whether this is in those bounds or not. And so I think similarly here, President Trump could concede that the Nixon case applies and that he can't challenge the procedures that the Senate uses. But if this is not a proper impeachment, if you can't impeach people after they've left office so that this isn't proper, you can't make up new things to impeach for, then maybe the court would look at that. I still think they wouldn't. I still think this is within the bounds of the House and Senate to say, what is an impeachment? How do we do this in a way that was not President Powell? But I would be shocked if he didn't at least try to litigate that.
I think that's right. And speaking of Nixon, the other Nixon, Richard Nixon, do you know why? I mean, was there a discussion after Ford pardoned him about having a late impeachment and conviction and disqualification of Nixon? Why? I'm just curious. That was a very controversial thing that Ford did. It was unpopular at the time. Was there a discussion about a late impeachment for Nixon, and why didn't they go forward with it?
It did come up. I would say it wasn't overly prominent in the discussion because he was gone. He was pardoned. Of course, having been pardoned, that's more reason to go forward with the impeachment because they're not going to be able to prosecute him.
Right.
But there was an article in the Duke Law Journal at the time that said Nixon can still be impeached. And Raoul Berger had written an important book on impeachment, and there was another article around the same time that took Berger to task for not talking about late impeachment. And the political atmosphere was very charged. The president was very unpopular. He wasn't going to face any consequences other than losing his job. And some law professors, took pen to paper about it, but it didn't really go anywhere.
I just wonder why, given that it was certainly available to Congress and the precedents were known, and given what you said, the pardon in a way puts more pressure on impeachment because he can't be subject to trial. And there was such anger at Ford for doing it. It seems strange to me that there wasn't more discussion of it in the Congress.
It is strange. And I think Ford's notion that we needed to move on, and also the notion that Nixon had suffered enough, wasn't persuasive to everyone, maybe not even to most people, but he did succeed in turning the temperature down enough that people wanted to be done with Watergate in a way that I think would have made impeachment awkward. And really, disqualification would be the only result, and it didn't look like Nixon was in danger of returning to office. He could run for president again. He'd already been elected twice. There was the issue of his pension, but that wouldn't have really taken away his pension either under the former President's Act. So I think part of it was that it wouldn't have really had enough consequence to be worthwhile.
Speaking of the former President's Act, as I recall, it ties compensation to the president not being removed from office, i.e. it says that the president receives compensation unless he was removed from office. Is that right?
Yes. There's a Facebook post that went viral that I've gotten a lot of calls from fact checkers about. It says, they could go after him after he's left office, and if they impeach him, then he'll lose his pension. And that's just not true. Former President's Act gives all of these benefits, office space, security, travel funds, and the pension, to any president who finished his term, or if he didn't finish his term, the reason was something other than being removed. So Nixon resigned. He wasn't impeached and convicted, so he's fine. If you're impeached and convicted, then you don't get your pension, unless the conviction doesn't happen until you're already gone, in which case you do. But that's the current law. They could change that. And I know they've got to be thinking about that. I'm sure we'll see some people introducing legislation to change the pension rules. Question if that's constitutional or not to do as a possible attainder. But I think we'll be seeing some discussion of changing that law going forward.
But I don't want to make too much of this, but it seems, though, that the law, by tying the absence of compensation to removal, I mean, if a late impeachment were a live possibility, they certainly wouldn't want an ex-president to have compensation if he were impeached after he left office and convicted. So it seems to me that statute, they were at least thinking, they weren't thinking it through fully about late impeachment. They limited it to removal.
I think that's right. I think that they didn't think about late impeachment. I don't think that if they knew then what we know now, that they would have phrased it the way they did. But again, they might amend it to do just that. One thing I do want to acknowledge is that there are state cases, and I mentioned some of the earlier state cases where late impeachment was done, but there are some more recent ones where late impeachments were disallowed by courts. The most recent case I'm aware of is a Florida case. And in the Florida case, by a 4-3 vote, so again, it's if nothing else, it's a close question. The Florida Supreme Court said, under the language and structure of the Florida Constitution, you can't late impeach someone. And that was a 1978 case called Smith versus Brantley. So I do want to concede that.
Yeah, right.
But it's ambiguous. It's distinguishable. It's an amazing question because we've got so many pieces of evidence to work with here and nothing that is just definitive. 554 footnotes in my article and none of them really bury one side.
No, but there is a lot to work with, and I agree with you that on balance, the evidence, you might put it more strongly than this, but I think on balance, the evidence favors late impeachment at a minimum. But I think a senator could, in good conscience, look at the text and structure and at the uncertainties in the precedent. And I think it's certainly available to reach the opposite conclusion, which I think you also agree with.
What I would hope is that whatever they do, they're clear about what they're saying. Are you saying we cannot do this? Or are you saying in this case, it's not worth it because he's already gone? Is it a bad idea as a general matter to late impeach? But make it clear whether you're voting about the law or about the facts.
I agree that would be great, but I predict we won't get that clarity.
Probably a safe bet.
Brian, thank you so much. That was very enlightening. I'm very grateful.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to lawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.